Okay, folks, you're listening to the latest chapter, the latest adventures, and the latest happenings on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann, this is the last one of the year because we have to let our readers know we're both going to be busy over Christmas, both away next week, so we won't be doing one between Christmas and the New Year. Look forward to seeing everybody in 23. But it's been, you know, certainly a very, well, energetic year in the world of politics and health and everything else. And pretty much for you as well, Miss Jones, with all the projects that you've undertaken and some new ones in the new year. I'm not sure if you can tell us about them, can you?
Something's cooking. It has been a very busy year this one, though, hasn't it?
Yeah,
And always surprises. You know, I sometimes listen to friends who are a bit dejected, a bit down in the dumps, and they'll say things like, well, I've got nothing on the cards for, you know, the next few months. Something always comes up. Mm. We have this little saying called SWATU,
right.
S-W-A-T-U, which means literally something will always turn up.
Right.
And as you often say, life turns on a sixpence.
Yes.
Something always does arise that turn things around.
Yeah.
So I think everybody has to be positive, have hope. Yes, it seems really crap right now out there. Everything is going wrong.
Yep.
Everybody's going on strike. You and I are not going on strike, by the way, because if we did, we wouldn't get paid. But, you know, we've got to have hope and we've got to expect always that things will get better because they will.
No, I totally agree with you. You know, throughout my career, I thought, what's going to happen when newspapers run down? Oh, suddenly radio came along. You know, what's going to happen if radio runs down? Oh, look, there's podcasts. What happens if podcasts? Oh, there's television. I totally agree with you. And the longer you go on, the more you think, A, well, nothing new can happen now, but B, the longer life does go on, the more likely there's something new will happen. You know, it's new technology and all that kind of stuff. So I totally agree with you. And I say to all our millions of listeners out there, just have optimism, look to the future with confidence, believe in yourself, you can do it. And, you know, the expectancy of doing it and getting it done is what keeps us all going.
Absolutely. Quite right, too.
Absolutely. Now, Miss Jones, I saw that you've been to see rather a special pantomime recently. Please.
Oh, yes, I have.
Oh, yes, you have. Tell us all about that.
Oh, so my son, Henry Shine, is starring as
Whenever, whenever you mention Henry's name, Henry Shine, I always think of that song. Shush, shiny shine, shush, shush, hidey high. There was a song, wasn't there, like that?
Oh, yeah. Who was that? Kajagooga?
I don't know.
Wait. Too, I think it was actually Too Shy.
Oh, Too Shy.
Not Shoe Shine.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
A friend of mine, Guy Chadwick, who was in a band called The House of Love, still is, actually, has got a great new album out. Just finished a tour of America.
Right.
His most famous song was She Shine On.
Oh.
And I always apply that one to Henry because he's a great, big, bouncy boy, full of life, got a fantastic singing voice. I would say that, wouldn't I?
Of course.
But yes, he does. And this is his fourth outing as the Beast in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
He's absolutely magnificent. The show went down an absolute storm there yesterday. And
where was it?
This is at the Camberley Theatre in Surrey.
Okay.
Not a million miles from you, actually.
No, exactly.
And, it was a funny thing. They have the big sort of wedding scene at the end of this pantomime.
Right.
So they all go off to do a big change of costume. So two elves come on to entertain the troops while the big change is happening backstage.
Yep.
And because they read out a list of, you know, names, shout-outs.
Right.
Shout-outs, as Steve Wright used to call them. And they called out Mother of the Beast.
Right.
which is me.
Right.
So I had to get up and give a bow in the theatre, and I got a round of applause simply for having produced The Beast. How about that?
Well done. It means you've contributed at least one great thing to life, Miss Jones.
I've brought my beast to the theatre.
That's right. Apart from all the brilliant books you've written and your 30-year career in journalism. So
stop it.
That's absolutely fantastic. Well done. Oh, that's great. And how long does that go on for?
Until New Year's Eve.
Oh, right, OK. We used to go to the pantomime when I was a little kid to the Liverpool Empire Theatre, OK? And I could never quite work out what the pantomime season was. It never seemed to be Christmas. It seemed to be before or after, you know what I mean? Sometimes as late as sort of middle of January. But we used to love the pantomime. But the worst memory I've got of it is that we were coming back from the pantomime on January in my dad's Morris Minor estate, and a driver jumped the lights at a place called Great Sutton on the Wirral and smashed into our car, and my elder sister nearly lost her hand.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, she had a hand on the windowsill. Those cars are so old, they had sliding windows, you see what I mean? And as the impact of the car that hit us, you know, it propelled the window shut, and she nearly lost all the fingers on her hand, and it was touch and go for a while. But it was
that's horrifying. Is she okay?
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, she had some like microsurgery or whatever. But it was a very traumatic night because the car was written off, and there was, you know, debris from the car all over the road, and some very kind people stopped, and my mum got in the ambulance with my sister to go to the hospital, and my dad had to look after the other two of us, me and my little sister. And there was a bloke who ran a nightclub nearby, not a nightclub, a sort of gambling place. And he took us in there and gave us pop and sandwiches and all that kind of stuff. I remember it now. We were only very young, you know. But anyway, there you go. And I can't remember going to a pantomime after that. But
well, I'm not surprised, really. It probably had negative connotations for you after that. Yeah, but pantos, I remember going to pantos. You know, we used to go with the brownies and the school things like that. Yeah. And so it would always be during term time, I suppose. So we must have gone back to school after Christmas.
Maybe, yeah.
And then be taken to the local panto.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember writing a panto once.
Oh.
When we were in the Girl Guides, and I played Buttons.
Oh.
So it must have been Cinderella, mustn't it? Yeah.
It must have been indeed. I hope your son Henry is making, you know, a good living out of it, because I know some people who do pantomimes and they do them for 6 weeks, and it can form 2/3 of their whole annual income, you know, for the year, because you can get paid very well if you've got full houses in pantomimes. They're very successful, aren't they?
Well, yes, they are. And I'm sure that Dawn French, who's currently starring in, I forget which pantomime, Jack and the Beanstalk, maybe?
Right.
It's at the Palladium. And she's actually working on Christmas Day because they're performing on Christmas Day.
Wow.
And she was talking about that the other day, that she's not actually getting Christmas this year. And the interviewer made a very good point. He said to her, "But you are giving Christmas this year, and isn't that a wonderful thing?"
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, that's very good. Well, so the London Palladium's open on Christmas Day and the pantomime's being performed?
Apparently so.
Wow, I didn't know that. I mean, the big shock in our industry was the first year that Rupert Murdoch decided there was going to be a newspaper on Boxing Day, okay?
So you had to work Christmas Day.
You had to work Christmas Day. Yeah. That's absolutely right.
I remember doing it.
Sorry?
I remember doing it.
Oh, well, I always volunteered because I wasn't married, and some guys that were around me were married, had children, all that kind of stuff. You know, I said, I'll do Christmas Day. So a lot of it you made sure had been written in advance, but you had to wait for your royal reporter. Ashley Walton was my royal reporter, to get to Sandringham, you know, and do the, you know, the church visit on Christmas Day and all that kind of stuff. And sadly, you had to round up the, you know, the terrible accidents from Christmas Eve and all that kind of stuff. But I always made a point of doing Christmas Day. I used to get in at 6 a.m, start putting the paper together, and then at 3 p.m. I was out. And it must have put the family to terrible trouble all those years, because for about 10 years this went on. They couldn't have Christmas lunch until I got there at 4 o'clock, you know.
I think that's a very civilized time because you could watch the Queen give her speech at 3 o'clock and then you could have a nice cocktail and then you could settle down to an early evening Christmas dinner. It's much more civilized.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And of course, I had a lot of catching up to do in terms of the vino because they'd all been on it since breakfast.
You were never shy coming forward to catch up on the vino, though, Mike.
I never was. Now, talking about Christmas, Miss Jones, because, as I say, this is the last one I'm going to do before Christmas and last one this year. I've had a bit of a Twitter campaign about the miserable bums who have been sending me Christmas cards, but only with a second-class stamp on them. And I actually take quite exception to that because I've sent out about 48 cards, right? And they've all had first-class stamps on them, which these days costs about 45 quid because a first-class stamp is 95p. But I never think of the cost. To me, you are showing respect for the person you're sending the card to by making sure that there's a big red first-class stamp on it. All the cards that have dropped through my door so far have horrible green second-class stamps on them, and I feel quite offended.
Mm. Well, second class stamps are completely pointless, first of all, because things don't get through on time. But second of all, there's no point sending any cards this year anyway, because they're not going to get there till about March. And have you seen the photographs of the depots completely overflowing with parcels and letters and cards? And the foxes and squirrels and rats are getting in there, chewing their way through all this stuff. What is the point? If they don't want to work, I'm sorry, but I have no time for these strikers, you know. Yeah. If they don't want to do the job, let somebody else do it. Yeah. No, there's not much money in it at the moment, but there's not much money in anything.
Yeah.
If you've got a job, you're very lucky.
Yes.
I don't think anybody should be striking. I've got no sympathy. Sorry if that is offensive to anyone listening. Yeah. But do the job or get out. And I think a lot of people will now say, well, I got out of the habit of sending cards last year. I'm not going to bother anymore. I'm going to send an e-card. Mm. Now, I've already had about a dozen e-cards so far this year. I never even open them because I find it quite offensive. I can't hang that on my mantelpiece.
No, you can't.
I can't show that to my family and friends. Yep. I can't decorate my house with an email.
Yeah, no.
So sorry, but either do the thing properly or don't bother.
No, I totally agree with you. I only sent them to, you know, people who I know won't get offended if they don't get one. Even last year, my sister didn't get her Christmas card from me until 15th of January, and there was no industrial action then. So, you know, what time she'll get this year? I have absolutely no idea. But it's the thought that counts.
It is the thought that counts, but don't send me an email. Is what I'd like to say to, to the rest of them who are going to.
Yes.
Just don't bother. Yeah. You know, we catch up all throughout the year. Anyone you're not in touch with and you only send a card to at Christmas, is there really any point?
Yeah, well, no, I totally agree with you there. So there we are. Now, one man will be home for Christmas will be Boris Becker, okay? Now, I've got a soft spot for Boris.
I know you have.
Yeah, I think he's a wonderful guy. I remember I just got back from America for a month in summer when Wimbledon came on. And I, in America, he'd been a sensation already because he'd won Queens, which is the warm-up tournament in London before Wimbledon, you know, because Wimbledon is still the world's biggest tennis tournament they take a great interest in America. And I thought, what a fascinating young fella. And so when I got back, I said to everybody, I'm going to put money on Boris Becker winning Wimbledon. And they all scoffed, you know, you know, I said, no, I said, you know, I've listened to some American tennis experts. They're saying this guy's a phenomenon. Anyway, needless to say, he won. He won the following year when he was 18. And I think he won it. I think it was 5 years later, but he's won it three times altogether. And of course, he's an Anglophile. He paid £22,000 a month to rent a house in Wimbledon because it was near to the court where he'd won all his titles. And now, after being jailed for hiding all his money when he'd been declared bankrupt, he gets out of jail. The prison van takes him to Biggin Hill Airport, right? Obviously, a you know famous RAF airport of the past, but now a private aeroplane airport. And he jumps on a Learjet and whoosh, within 50 minutes, he lands back in Germany. That's quite a stylish way to get out of jail, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, what do we think? Has he learned his lesson, or is he going to defraud people and be a thief and a cheat for the rest of his life?
Well, I would think the second is closer to the first, because if you do it once and you think you've got away with it, then you're probably going to do it again. Nevertheless, this is a tale of two Borises. I also have a soft spot for Boris Johnson, because I think he's a very appealing character. I love the way he speaks. I love the way he's up front and explains himself and wins people over. But again, you know, Boris is a conundrum of sort of, you know, good and bad, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. His own best friend, his own worst enemy. He will always play by his own rules. There are people who do that and they get away with it. And you have to admire them. Yep. You also have to think there, but for the grace of God. Somebody who flies very close to the wind. Yeah. Somebody who takes risks. We all have to take risks in life. Some people take greater risks than others.
Yeah.
I sometimes look at Boris Johnson and think, how are you still alive? He obviously lives a very unhealthy lifestyle. You see him out jogging every now and again in his shorts. Yeah. And I think he sort of makes a gesture now and again. He's got a very young wife. Mm. He's got very young next set of children. I know he's got loads of grown up ones as well. Yeah. But, yeah, he's got a lot to keep going for, hasn't he?
Yeah, he certainly has. Somebody who knows a lot more about politics than me said that watch out for Boris because there's going to be local council elections next May, OK? Tories will probably get thrashed because all incumbent governments do and they're in a particularly parlous state. And that might be the next time that Boris might literally launch a comeback. He'll have earned a couple of million more quid on the speaking circuit by then and might feel that he wants to return to the fray. But who knows? Politics is in a...
Question. Do you think he would ever do such a thing as previous illustrious prime ministers have done and jump sides?
No. I can't see where he'd jump to. I mean, he is the figurehead of the Tory party. You know, he won Mayor of London title twice as a Tory. I don't think there's anywhere for him to jump, to be honest. Mm. I mean, where would you think he would jump if he jumped sides?
Well, I don't know. They tend to do these dramatic things. Could you see him displacing Sir Keir Starmer, for example?
No, goodness gracious, no, not at all, no. I mean, I'm not sure he was ever a Brexiteer. I think that was just an opportunist move, you know what I mean? They're looking for somebody to lead the Brexit campaign. Let me see. He wrote two columns, apparently, for The Telegraph, where he was paid £250,000 a year. And one of them was advocating Brexit, and the other one was advocating Remain. And up until the last minute, couldn't make his mind up which one to submit to the editor. And in the end, it was Brexit. And that's what signed him on. Anyway, there we go.
Disgraceful.
Yeah.
May I, as we're talking, I know that by the time our podcast broadcasts, this will be well known, but breaking news as we speak.
Yes.
I'd like to offer condolences to the Watts family because Shirley Watts, Charlie Watts's wife, has just died.
Oh my goodness gracious. That's terrible. How long ago did Charlie Watts die?
That's last August, wasn't it?
Good.
Or the previous August, I think. Yeah, it's not very long ago anyway. When did my book come out? It was July. So it was August 2020 when Charlie died.
No, it wasn't that long ago, was it?
I'm sure it was because my book came out. Yeah, no. It was August. I know it was August. Mm. And then the Stones did the tour of the States in December 2020.
Yeah.
And then, no, hang on. I'm completely wrong. My book came out this year. It's 2022. Exactly. So Charlie died 2021.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That makes more sense. And his wife's just died.
Yeah.
I mean, do we know why or how?
Don't know. I mean, she was getting on a bit, wasn't she? She'd also had her battle with alcoholism in previous years and so on. But who knows? I mean, she was about Charlie's age, so into her 80s.
Mm. Yeah, well.
So, you know, it could just be old age.
Charlie, yeah, amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Rock and roll people tend not to last into their 80s.
No,
I know we've got a few now. We've got Cliff Richard and we've got Mick and Keith still going on. But, you know, as I keep saying, within 10 years, we won't have any of them left.
No, I totally agree.
So we've got to make the most of them now. Did you see Cliff Richard's Christmas special, by the way?
I've seen Cliff Richard on the TV in the last couple of days. I'm not sure.
He did a Christmas special on BBC Two.
Yeah.
And my great friends, Brian Bennett and Bruce Welsh, who were obviously in the shadows, they came on and did a number with him. They did Move It, Cliff's first hit, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
But Cliff is looking a little, yeah, he's looking a bit ropey around the edges, got to say.
He also speaks very funnily. Has he had his teeth gone?
Do you know exactly that? He speaks as though he's got somebody else's teeth in.
He does, yeah. Speaks as though trying to keep something in his mouth, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, I know it gets difficult for them because I remember this with my dad.
Yeah.
You know, there comes a point where they can't wear their bridge anymore. Lots of them have that generation have bridges, don't
right,
they?
Right.
And the gums wear down to the point that it won't support the bridge anymore. So then sometimes, as my father did, they have to have implants,
right,
which never really take because there isn't enough gum left.
Yeah, I know.
So they end up drilling into the bone.
Yeah.
It's a horrible procedure. Mm. And then the implants never really
fit
properly.
No, I know. My dentist has warned me of that. I've got a gap in the back of my mouth and I said, we'll put an implant in. He said, there's not enough gum left for us to get into it.
Oh,
you don't need it, you know.
It's horrible. We're all going to be living on soup by the time we get to that age.
I think we are. Talking about pop stars, by the way, I read a big interview with Dave Davis, who is the brother of Ray Davis, who founded the Kinks, and all the battles he had with his brother over money and all that. And there was one piece in it which stood out to me. What was your first job? And he said his first job was as a newspaper boy. He said, I only did it one day. I hated it and I never went back. I can't believe that. I loved being a newspaper boy. I loved that job, getting up in the morning, you know, getting on your bike, down the shop, get the papers. And I used to finish my round so quick, I'd get back before some other people had turned up and do their round as well. But they had a very fraught relationship, didn't they, Dave Davis and Ray Davis?
Right from childhood.
Yeah.
Dave puts it down to the attention that he got from his sisters, his elder sisters, and his aunties when he was a child. So he came along and he displaced Ray. Mm. Ray had previously been the youngest child and the only boy in the family.
Oh, there were six and then sisters, weren't there? Six sisters and two boys,
yeah.
Is that right?
So along comes nice little baby Dave,
yeah,
and Ray's nose is put out of joint. Mm. And there was this underlying resentment all those years.
Really?
He also made a point of stealing all the limelight and all the credit. Ray never gave Dave any songwriting credit, any riff writing credit.
But he didn't do anything, did he? It was all Ray.
Well, yeah, no. Take for example the song "You Really Got Me." Dave is the guitarist. He wrote the guitar licks on that piece. And in fact, they had a legal battle in 2014.
Yes.
And it was proved beyond doubt that Dave had contributed those guitar licks to that to that song.
Isn't that amazing?
But I just think if you're brothers, you know, you've got to look at the bigger picture.
Yeah.
If you want to maintain your band and maintain your popularity and go forward as brothers and friends and bandmates,
yeah,
you've got to concede a little bit.
Yeah, well,
and it seems to me like Ray Davis has never conceded to anybody.
Yeah, I interviewed him once. He came into my radio studio. I think he was doing a compilation album or something or other. And he's the thinnest man I've ever seen. I mean, you know, really, really thin and tall and lanky. I mean, ever so nice, but I've seen a lot of pop stars who get into their 70s and 80s who look like that. And somebody said to me, well, actually, what you're looking at is the way that a lot of pop stars abuse themselves in their, you know, their 20s and their 30s. Not that I'm suggesting for a moment that Ray Davis did. That was a general comment put to me by the lifestyle of people in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. I mean, don't they say, isn't there some line about, by the time you get to 70, you're wearing the face you deserve?
Maybe. I don't know. I'll let you know.
Or did I just make that up?
No, you might have made that up. I'll let you know when I get there, Miss Jones. I'm still in early middle age, as you well.
Of course you are, yes.
Absolutely. Right, okay, folks, you're listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, the Rothschild writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. And this is the last one of the year 22. We won't be with you next week in between Christmas and New Year, as we're all going to be out and about with festive activities, but see you again in 23. Now, Miss Jones, I saw you put out a piece the other night, and I think it was the anniversary of a piece you'd written years ago about your father and the terrible trauma that hit your family when your dad was swept under a train in a crowded railway station and lost his arm.
He did. This wasn't a piece I'd written before. I'd never written about it, actually.
No.
although I did in a book I wrote called Tumbling Dice, mm-hmm. which was my memoir. Yep. But I hadn't written about what happened at the time. And this was the 30th anniversary, unbelievably.
Wow.
And my father made his name at the Daily Mirror as the voice of sport. Yep. And it was a great honor to be commissioned to write this piece, remembering what had happened.
Yeah.
And I sort of walked myself back through it, hand in hand with the ghost of Christmas past.
Golly, yeah.
To relive those details. Mm. And it's amazing what will come back to you after 30 years.
Mm. No, I bet it is.
So many details, so many little bits and pieces, you know, images of my grandmother there the night that it happened and so on. But but 30 years, and it feels like last week.
Yeah, I bet it does. And I didn't realise it happened at London Bridge and London Bridge Station in London, for the benefit of our millions of listeners who don't live in London, is a station I use often to get the train back down to Stockbroker Belt, Surrey. So, mind you, it's changed an awful lot over the years. It's been renovated so massively now that, you know, you wouldn't recognise it from the days when your dad lost it. But what a terrible trauma that must have been. You're on your way.
Oh, horrible. And just horrible.
Next minute, you're lying like you're pinned under a train. It's unimaginable.
It was so traumatic for all of us. I think as a family, the fallout, it lasted for such a long time. There were sort of inter-family feuds as well. I think we all just turned on each other at one point. We just couldn't, because he was the most wonderful man, my father.
Yeah.
I know many of us feel that about our fathers, but to me, he was my best friend. He was the man I loved the most, the man I'd known the longest in my life.
Sure.
And we just didn't know how to cope with it.
But no,
there was my poor dad. He was, while they were trying to cut him out from underneath the train, there was an ambulance man, a paramedic, as we would now call them, kneeling between the rails, holding my father's head in his hands.
Yeah.
And my father was slipping away because it was taking them so long to cut him out from under the train.
Yeah.
And he kept saying, "Hold on, Ken, hold on. Yeah. I've got this. I've got you. Yeah. If it's the last thing I'll do, I'll get you through this." Yeah. And after he had some surgery to tidy up what was left of the missing arm, my dad said, "You got to find me that ambulance man. I need to speak to him. I need to meet him. I need to talk to him. I need to say thank you."
Yeah.
I tried everything.
Mm.
And, you know, I was a newspaper woman. Sure. It wasn't as if I couldn't contact the service agencies. I was very good at finding people, very diligent. Mm. I tried everything. Mm. And I couldn't find him. And it soon occurred to me that I wasn't supposed to find him. You're not allowed to have relationships with these people. The only way they can do that job is by retaining their impartiality and by staying above and outside of the emotional aspect of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't get to know people, patients, victims of accidents, because they would then internalize all that emotion and they wouldn't be able to do the job.
Mm. Yeah,
but we never found him, and it was sad.
I can understand that. I never got on with my father, actually. I don't know why, but from a very early age, we just didn't gel at all. He wanted me to do terribly well at school, and I wasn't always that diligent in my school studies, and if I brought home a bad report, it would cause terrible trouble for 2 or 3 weeks at home and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? And I think he kind of resented me in a way, because when I got my first job on the Daily Express, that was the first job on a national newspaper, it was a big deal in those days, as you well know. You know, I think about 300 people applied for the job. It was advertised in the Press Gazette. News reporter wanted for Daily Express Manchester. Write to Stanley Blenkinsop, news editor, and the address was Great Ancoat Street, Manchester, you know. So I had to handwrite letter because I didn't want anybody to know I was planning it, you know. And I got down to a shortlist of 30, then a shortlist of 3, and I got the job. And I was, you know, so overwhelmed. It was such a great thing to become a reporter on a national newspaper, and everybody else wanted it. And when I told my dad, his response was, I mean, he'd been a Daily Express reader all his life, ever since coming out of the Navy after the end of the Second World War. But he decided to change to the Daily Mail. And he said to me, you know, "What do you mean you've got a job on the Daily Express?" Said, "The Daily Express doesn't take people like you. They take people like Cassandra," who was the legendary features writer. You know, he said, "The Daily Express is the paper of John Juna." And I pointed out John June was actually the editor of the Sunday Express, you know. He said, but it's the same group. He said, I don't expect my Daily Express to be written by people like you and changed to the Daily Mail.
Oh, dear. That's horrible envy.
Yeah.
He couldn't stand to see you rising above him and doing so well. It's very common, especially in fathers,
right,
who don't like to, because men are fragile. Mm. You know, men don't give birth. It all boils down to that. Yeah. And I'm not saying all men, but there is a fragility in certain kinds of fathers that can't stand to see their child exceed them in life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it could be the point. And, you know, these super wealthy families, I'm thinking of the TV series Succession, which people think is largely based on the Rupert Murdoch family, the media, you know, magnate.
Has to be, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they have terrible problems, you know, in coping with each other, with the wealth and the power and the glory and the envy and the rivalry. And so I suppose there's a little bit of that in it. I do give my father due credence to the fact that he suffered real mental health problems after the war. You know, he came out of the war and it was a terrible trauma he'd been involved in since the age of 17. So I don't really think he knew how to cope with life. But there we go.
That's very interesting, because I was listening to Jeremy Vine's radio show on BBC Radio 2.
Oh, yeah.
With his resident doctor, Dr. Sarah Jarvis.
Oh, I know Sarah very well, and yeah.
Their piece today was about post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
And she made the point that during the First World War and afterwards, people who were shell-shocked were shot for
cowardice.
Not being kept for cowardice.
Yeah. Couldn't go back into battle.
Which is the most hideous thing.
Yeah, exactly. Couldn't walk back onto the battlefield, and therefore you're a coward and they shot you. It was even worse in the Napoleonic Wars down on the coast, you know, where I've lived for many years now. There was there's a military hospital, a naval hospital, and the soldiers who fought it, the sailors who fought in the Napoleonic Wars, they had their legs blown off, or they had an arm blown off, or whatever, by a cannonball from the French or the Spanish. They were taken to this hospital. I've forgotten its name right now, but it was in a creek. Right. And they were taken to the hospital, they were patched up, and then they were sent back on a ship, back to the war zones. I mean, can you imagine that? You know, you one leg blown off, but they give you a wooden leg and then send you back, put a bit of tar on.
And they expect you to still be useful in the battlefield.
Yeah.
That's just appalling.
That's right. And I wish I could remember the name of the hospital. It's on the tip of my tongue, but it's called something Creek. And that's where the expression of up the creek without a paddle comes from. Once you got in there, it meant you were going to be drafted back into the Navy. And I don't think any of us ever understand the trauma that that war has on individuals. Now, Miss Jones, don't want to get into maudlin-type stories, but when I recently pointed out to you that Gary Glitter is coming out of jail after 8 years and a free man to roam the streets again, you told me an amazing story I've never heard before, that you've had quite a lot of personal involvement in trying to find out about Gary Glitter's life.
Yeah, in a way. Gary Glitter groomed my sister, my youngest sister.
This is amazing.
Back in the 80s, I was co-presenting a rock magazine show on Channel 4 television.
Right.
With Gary Crowley and Nicky Horn from Capital Radio.
I know Nicky. I worked with him at TalkSport, yeah.
Yeah, and Gary Glitter came in to... Studio day was Fridays, because the show used to go out as live on a Saturday evening.
Right.
And so on Fridays, we had studio where bands came in, performed as live, did the interviews, all that kind of thing. And Gary Glitter came down to the studio to do an interview with Nicky Horn. Mm. And we got chatting in the green room. My sister was with me that day.
How old is your sister?
She was 12 at the time.
Golly.
And she was on half term or school holiday, and she was dying to come down to the studio where she could meet Spandau Ballet and all the rest of the guys.
Yeah.
Because she's a little pop fan, you know.
Mm.
And he started chatting to her at the buffet. He was wearing a gigantic ruby ring,
mm-hmm.
looked like a boiled sweet,
right,
set in gold.
Right.
And he said he would give it to her if she played her cards right.
Mm.
Now, I was very young, very innocent myself in those days. I didn't think anything of it. And one thing led to another. He befriended me
mm-hmm.
and started to arrange to meet up. And again, I didn't think anything of it. I suppose I was very flattered that this very famous pop star wanted to be friends with me. He was much older than me, so I just thought
he was
of it
very
as
famous, by the way. I mean, he had
very, very famous
number
at
one
that time.
LPs at the top of the charts and everything. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And we started hanging out, and he'd always say when we arranged to meet for lunch and whatever else, "Can Sam come? Is Sam around?" Mm. And I just didn't even twig, you know. And then he had this boat that he had moored in the marina down at Brighton.
Right.
And he used to invite us down to have these lost weekends on the boat.
Golly.
And anyway, one thing led to another. He was never alone with her, is all I can say.
Right.
And there came a moment when the penny dropped.
Mm.
And when I realised what was going on. And sort of withdrew from the friendship, if you like. And then was absolutely horrified a few years later when obviously he went off to live in Vietnam and then it all came out, didn't it?
Yeah.
And how it came out for me, I'd just given birth to my son.
Right.
So it's about 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was upstairs in bed, shortly home from hospital. Mm. I was feeding my baby, lying in bed, and my husband came up to the bedroom looking very stern, and he said, "There are two police officers at the front door, want to speak to you. Do you mind telling me what you've done?"
Yeah.
And of course I hadn't done anything. I didn't know what this was about at all. Mm. And they'd found in cuttings a couple of interviews that I had done with Gary Glitter over the years of Fleet Street.
Right.
And they just wanted to talk to me about what I knew about him.
Golly. And so.
But that was the moment I realized. Yeah. It took a few more years, but it was the moment I realized my marriage was dead because my husband jumped to a conclusion that was negative about me.
Yeah.
And it was only a matter of time. I think I always knew that in the back of my mind that we were heading down the Swanee. Yeah.
I mean, he was pretty thick, Gary Glitter, because the way he got found out was he went into a PC World, I think it was, or some computer store. He knackered up his laptop computer and asked them to fix it for him. And he left it with them, went away. When he came back, he was arrested because they'd found, you know, amazingly horrible images of children on his computer.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of horrible stuff goes on in the dark web.
Yeah.
Stuff that we wouldn't even imagine in our worst nightmares, you know?
I totally agree.
And he was obviously corrupted by all that. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, now they're talking about releasing him in end of January, beginning of February.
Yeah.
He served half his sentence for rape and assault and child abuse. One of his youngest rape victims was 8 years old. Now, that person and others like her, that I think there was a 10-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 13-year-old, and so on, those people are serving life sentences. Why isn't he?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I only ever met him once. I was running the Press Association, and so whenever there was a round of interviews, they always came there because it went to all the regional papers and that kind of stuff, you know. And he came in, and whenever he signed an autograph for anybody, you know, lots of, you know, young people there impressed with him, he signed it "Leader." And I thought, you know, how odd. Anybody could be Leader, but there's only one Gary Glitter, you know.
Well, he was the leader, wasn't he? He was the leader of the pack.
The leader of the gang and all that, and his record and all that kind of stuff. But he's a very arrogant man, you know.
But he was tongue-in-cheek. There was a very self-deprecating humour about him.
Okay.
You know, he made no bones about the fact that he wore a wig, for example.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And he would take the wig off and sort of twirl it on his finger and chuck it across the room and things.
Yeah.
He did look very different without the wig.
Yeah. Oh, no, he did, yeah.
I've got a set of photos that I sometimes can bear to look at of all of us, him hugging my sister, him hugging me and all of this. And it gives me the creeps, I just can't understand how this person, who is very recognisable, even now, as a bald man with a sort of a Mandarin moustache and so on, how is he going to live any semblance of a normal life when everywhere he goes, people know who he is and what he did?
People will, I mean, they will literally, if it was 300 years ago, people would stone him in the streets, wouldn't they? He's that repulsive a character for the crimes he's committed and all that kind of stuff. Now, talking about rock stars, can't go without a mention of the Beatles. I just happened onto 8 Days a Week, the Beatle film, while I was you know, surfing through a few channels the other night. And of course, once I saw it, I couldn't leave it alone. And I didn't realise that when the Beatles went on tour to America in 1964, so they were still very young, probably in their early 20s. One of them might have even been 20. I think it was 20. The Beatles refused to play in front of segregated audiences in the South of America. And I thought, for young men to have taken a stand like that in the deep South, you know, redneck territory in America, was incredibly brave.
Yeah, it was. It backfired on them slightly. Yeah. I mean, there were sort of a series of events where, you know, we know about after John Lennon made his remark about being more famous than Jesus Christ. Yeah. And there were bonfires held in towns all across the Deep South. They burned the records, any merchandise that people had about the Beatles. Mm. But they had principles and they had brains and they had that quintessential Liverpudlian view of life.
Yes.
And sense of humour. And they were way more intelligent than they were cracked down to be.
No.
You know who directed that film? Do you remember Happy Days on television?
Yes, I do. Ron Howard.
Yeah, Ron Howard. He directed that film. Co-exec producer.
Yeah, that's right.
But I think, you know, there was a load of footage in there from
Tuesday,
the
Happy Days.
That's
Tuesday,
the one.
Thursday. And his name was, what did the Fonz used to call him?
He was called Richie Cunningham.
Cunningham, that's right. The Fonz said, Cunningham, come here.
I absolutely loved Happy Days.
I did as well.
And I loved the spin-off. Was it Richie and Chachi or Chachi and Joni or something like that? Chachi and Joni, I love the Fonz. My dad loved the Fonz as well.
But it was cool. The Fonz, I loved him. Yeah.
Very cool. But there was quite a lot of footage from the Shea Stadium concert in 1965 in that.
There was.
And you look at that, you sort of analyze it now from the lens that we are standing in front of now.
Yeah.
That was less about the music because they only had the basic tannoy in Shea Stadium. They didn't have any proper broadcasting equipment or amplifying equipment there that day.
No.
So nobody could hear anything.
That's right.
The band themselves couldn't hear themselves playing.
That's right.
Ringo said he could only keep time playing the drums by watching Paul's and John's bums kind of moving from side to side as they were playing their guitar.
Yeah.
But I think the whole thing, it wasn't really about music in the beginning. This was about the sexual awakening of young girls and feeling sensations in their bodies that they'd never felt before.
Yeah, it was mass adulation, wasn't it?
And
of course, eventually led to the Beatles saying, what's the point of going on the road? Nobody ever listens to us because they can't hear us and all that kind of stuff. So, that was amazing.
It was all about sex. Yeah. Everything's about sex, though, isn't it?
I suppose it is at the end of the day. Now, as we're moving towards Christmas Day, I saw a great piece the other day on old, what's his name, Shane of the Teeth, Shane McGowan. And I didn't realise he was born on Christmas Day, Shane McGowan. And this piece is all about, you know, the change in Shane McGowan from the man whose teeth all crumbled and fell out to he's got a new pair of teeth and all that. And, of course, he made Fairy Tale in New York, didn't he, with Kirsty MacColl and all that. I mean, he's had quite an exciting life, hasn't he?
Yeah, I don't know much about his life, to be honest, in terms of it being exciting, but that is one of my favourite Christmas tunes.
Oh, I agree.
And, of course, poor George Michael died on Christmas Day, didn't he? So there's quite a lot of pop connections to Christmas Day
as well. And then didn't
his
sister die on Christmas Day 3 years later?
She did, yeah.
Good God, that's amazing.
Yeah, very, very strange scenario. But but Shane McGowan, I mean, I think at the time we all thought, The Pogues and Kirsty MacColl. I mean, that is a kind of marriage made in hell in a way.
Yeah.
But it's endured and it's become one of the great Christmas classics, hasn't it?
No, I totally agree. I got to know Kirsty MacColl's husband quite well when they were still married. They got divorced.
There's Steve Lillywhite.
Steve Lillywhite, who produced the U2 albums, didn't he? You know, with Bono. And
early on, yes, he did. Yeah. But, and my eldest daughter was at university with Tom Lillywhite, who was obviously Kirsty's nephew by marriage. But she came to a very, very horrible ending.
Shocking.
Which
cut up
we don't really want to talk about.
By the propeller of a speedboat while she was...
No, let's not do that.
No.
Let's remember lovely Kirsty as she was.
Oh, wonderful woman. Listen, one last thing, because, of course, you knew this lot very well, talking about Boy George. And his band. And again, I just read a paragraph in one of the papers this week that John Moss, the drummer and allegedly lover of Boy George, has now racked up £1 million in legal bills trying to get money back from the group. He says he was deprived of royalties that were due him. When these things happen, Leslie, as I'm sure you may well know, once you get into legal dispute and the meter starts ticking, it is a blinking nightmare, honest to God, because you come to a tipping point where you've got to say, right, I've had enough, I've got to pull out. Or you have to say, I've spent all this now, I can't pull out, I've got to get on and win and get my money back and get my costs. It's honestly, it's a horrible, I've been in it myself. I've had disputes in the past where I've had to go to court to get what I thought was mine. And it is honestly, I can, you know, poor old John Moss, as Christmas coming now, he must be biting his nails, you know, at the cost of the legal action he's taking.
Well, as Amber Heard found out to her cost, as Rebecca Vardy found out to her cost, you know, the person with the most money, it shouldn't be the case, but it always
it is.
The person with the most money will always win.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
And the best thing you can do is have dignity and learn the lesson and walk away and try and make a living by some other means.
No, I totally agree. The problem is sometimes you know you're in the right, but it can't be proven. Do you see what I mean? I've had discussions with barristers in the past, and I said, look, this can't be allowed to happen. You know full well that I'm in the right. He said, yeah, I do. He said, but we've got to convince a judge of that. And the other side have got, you know, three KC barristers, used to be called QCs, but they're now called KCs. He said, they'll just line up and they'll, you know, they'll pull your case to pieces. And, oh, it's one of those nightmare things. But
and the thing about a QC or KC... they can prove that black is white because they have the language and they have all the dodges. And, you know, even if they don't believe their client, they are being paid extraordinary amounts of money to prove that this guy didn't do what he did do or otherwise. Yeah. And if they're really good at their job. Yeah. So, you know, the law is an ass because of that, because so many times people walk free who actually did it. Yeah. And the other way round.
Yeah, no.
And I think the best thing we can all do is steer clear of the legal profession,
well,
really.
I agree. But then, you know, if you have principles, you sometimes say to yourself, no, I've got to fight this case. You know what I mean?
Well, if you've got money to burn, that's
well,
fine.
Well, even if you haven't got money to burn, but it's a question of pride, you're right, and all that kind of stuff. Miss Jones, let me ask you this. Are you ever bothered by urban foxes?
Yeah, I hate them. They killed our bunny rabbit. I can't stand them. I think they're dangerous. I think they carry parasites. Yeah. You see that lots of animals, pet animals, I mean, dogs, cats, small children, adults have been attacked by these horrible, hungry things. Yeah. They shouldn't be living in cities. They're fine in the countryside.
Yeah, but see,
I think there should be a drive to kind of put them back in the countryside.
Well, you say that. I'm talking to you because you might have seen the same piece as me in the Sunday Times Colour magazine, I think, last week.
I did, yeah.
And there's a bloke goes out and he just shoots them without any remorse, without any conscience. Apparently, you can just shoot foxes in this country and he shoots 10 a night. To clean up a neighbourhood, you know, and that kind of stuff.
But not only that, there are these guys out there, fox snipers. Yeah. It's £450 for a call out, and they charge £25 to £75 per fox exterminated.
Golly.
And people are hiring them. They're doing really well at this.
Golly, wow.
There's a job for you for the new year.
There's a future career there, isn't there? Yeah, I feel a little bit sorry for them. In round about April, when I sometimes see little cubs have been born and they're trailing around behind sort of mother fox and all that kind of stuff. But I agree that people who put out, you know, like slices of chicken and milk for them must be mad, because the last thing you want to do is try and domesticate a fox, isn't it?
I get so angry with those people.
Yeah.
I remember going to a dinner party in Sevenoaks years ago.
Yeah.
And the woman, the hostess, was she had floodlights on her back terrace,
right.
And she would put out all these dishes for the foxes, and they would all come down. It was like animals in the bush coming down to the watering hole after nightfall, and she was quite proud of the fact, showing us off her sort of semi-tame foxes.
Golly.
And I thought, well, you're not doing us any favours
I totally agree. I saw one attack a cat. I was coming home at 3 o'clock in the morning from a late shift somewhere, and turned my car into the road, and the headlights just caught a fox savaging a cat. I mean, really badly, you know what I mean? And
that's horrible. Yeah, and that's somebody's little pet.
Exactly. But anyway, there we go. Right. Okay, Miss Jones, it remains only for me to say have a great Christmas, have a great New Year. I hope that, you know, the festive season brings all that you wish. And, of course, I want to extend those very same sentiments to our millions of listeners. Folks, thank you very much indeed this year for having listened to Life on Planet Porky. See you again in 2023.
He's looking a bit ropey around the edges, got to say.
He also speaks very funnily. Has he had his teeth gone?
Do you know exactly that? He speaks as though he's got somebody else's teeth in.
He does, yeah. Speaks as though trying to keep something in his mouth, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, I know it gets difficult for them because I remember this with my dad.
Yeah.
You know, there comes a point where they can't wear their bridge anymore. Lots of them of that generation have bridges, don't
they? Right, right.
And the gums wear down to the point that it won't support the bridge anymore. So then sometimes, as my father did, they have to have implants,
right,
which never really take because there isn't enough gum left.
Yeah, I know what you
mean. They end up drilling into the bone.
Yeah.
It's a horrible procedure. And then the implants never really
fit
properly.
No, I know. My dentist has warned me of that. I've got a gap in the back of my mouth and I said, we'll put an implant in. He said, there's not enough gum left for us to get into it.
Oh.
You don't need it, you know. Said, Cunningham, come here.
I absolutely loved Happy Days.
I did as well.
And I loved the spin-off. Was it Richie and Chachi or Chachi and Joni or something like that?
Joni.
Chachi and Joni, yeah. I loved the Fonz. My dad loved the Fonz as well. But
it was cool. The Fonz, I loved him. A shush, shiny shine, shush, shush, hidey high. There was a song, wasn't there, like that?
Oh, yeah, who was that? Kajagoogoo?
I don't know.
Wait. Too, I think it was actually Too Shy.
Oh, Too Shy.
Not Shoe Shine.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
But,